Thank you very much, Don. Again, I want to add my thanks to the people who put it together. I was complicit in that. I was thinking when I was helping Don put this together, I was thinking, you know, I can be a cheerleader on this and then enjoy it. And they got down to signing things, because I figured since I worked on Hippolytes, I probably wasn't going to have a place on the program. And they got down and said, boy, we need somebody to work on biting flies, give the talk on biting flies. And I says, well, that's obviously Dan Klein. But they said, well, no, Dan's doing the genealogy, so you can do it. And I said, but I didn't work on the biting fly program when I was there. I said, okay, but that's okay. You can take care of it. Don't worry about it. So I'm in the unenviable position of talking about a lot of things that I don't know a lot about. And sometimes I think I get that impression that that's what some of my students think. But we'll give it a try here anyway. This is what we decided, and I have modified this in two ways. It was going to be Dick Axtell's legacy from North Carolina, Tennessee, Florida, and I have added California because of the significant contributions that one of Dick's grandchildren has made, Brad Mullins, and we'll talk about that. And I, if you will look down there, because of the extensive help that I've got in preparing this, and that I may get during the talk from Dan Klein, I have added his name in parentheses. I tried to add it as a, in the program, but they would not. The ESA doesn't allow that. Okay, I came up with a really lame way of going from one portion to the other, and I thought, well, you know, we've got the states in there, and I'll put the state up. And you know, then it dawned on me that everybody that worked with Dick or knew about Dick probably knew where North Carolina was. So there was a substantial portion of the program, of course, started in North Carolina. The North Carolina Biting Fly Research was sponsored by NOAA. Sea Grant had just gotten started, and there were grants from there, and COC is Department of Commerce. I have listed there as many of the people who contributed to that as I am sure of, and if I have left somebody out, I apologize. Henry Koch, Dan Klein, Bill Dale, Jim Dukes, Mike Tidwell, and Tommy Edwards. The map that you see in the middle left-hand side there is of Carteret County, and this is the area that they was the center of the biting fly, and actually there was mosquito research going on there at the same time, I believe also. And some of the places that we did, and that is from one of Dick's publications. I think it's Dick and Dan's publication about some of the places where they did some of their research. That area has changed extensively now. Some of those barrier islands were and still are essentially abandoned, but the area around B and on to the left there has now was sand dunes and salt marsh. And the salt marshes are still there, and the sand dunes are there, but there's sure an awful lot of houses and condos in there. And I got to go down a few times to help out with some of this, and got me hooked on that. And I go down just to the left of the B there every summer with as many of my family as I can get. The center, or the driving thing on the biting fly there, research along the coast is the salt marsh. And at the time that this research was being done, there was a lot of interest in salt marsh ecology at NC State because of the Sea Grant program. And there was I absorbed a lot of that and was very impressed by salt marshes. They had just come widely accepted that they were one of the drivers of the seafood, coastal seafood industry, and that they were very important. One of the things that was, one of the few things that was being done to control mosquitoes, it was primarily for mosquitoes, but also for other black flies, was that they were ditching parts of the salt marsh. And you can, I think you still fly on them today. They were 30 years old when we were doing it, and there were pictures of it. And these were called gridirons, and they were just straight lines to drain it, as well as, you know, didn't drain it very well. Some of the research that was came out of Dick's program on the Culicoides, and you see here some of the species that these graduate students worked on, which were salt, essentially. I think these are all salt marsh mosquitoes. They did work on what species were present, seasonal abundance. They worked a lot on trapping methods, and both adult and immatures. And I believe that in the Culicoides, as well as the mosquitoes, they found out that, and some of the, a lot of the experiments that these students did was to compare ditched salt marsh with salt marsh that had been undisturbed. And I believe that in both cases they found out that there was more biting fly and mosquito production in the places where they had tried to abate them, because there was trapped bodies of water in there and so forth. So, and that on the right is one, again, a thing from a one of the publications. The production of the biting flies was driven by the plant cover, and the plant cover is determined by elevation and how much it got, or how often it was flooded. A couple of kinds, high and low spartina being flooded by every tide twice a day, and then left dry, and then the higher ones were flooded only irregularly. And these are the things that drove where Culicoides and Tabanids were being produced. And okay, I got relation to plant cover and also diurnal activity. There's several publications that lay that all out. The Tabanidae, those are the people that I were aware that worked on this. Diurnal flight activity of the various, first of all, the species, diurnal flight activity of the various species, larval distribution, and collection methods. Daily activity, then I got larval distribution again. Well, the larval distribution, and that was on the right is another map of how they sampled. This was done by collecting mud or soil samples and washing it and find it in the larvae were very, very much dispersed, and in general indicated the futility of trying to control them in the larval stage. And this, of course, inferred this before, but the importance of the salt marshes had been established, and we were either had at the time knew that there were interventions that we couldn't use and were unlikely to be able to use in the future. So, you know, there was no more widespread application of insecticides, limited, if any at all, ditching of salt marshes and so forth. These have become wetlands, which have become, to a great extent, untouchable. The collection for the Tabanid larvae was one of the things that a lot of the students and technicians really didn't like. was done out on the salt marshes, oftentimes in cold weather. And people really like to go to the coastal areas during the summertime. But unless you've got a really good reason, you don't want to go there during the wintertime when the wind's blowing 30 miles an hour. Had a great also effect on adult collections. They had to build Manitoba traps that would withstand 40 to 50 miles an hour wind. Okay, we're going to move to Florida. Dan has already given a little bit of what he's done. His research and the Florida research has all been Dan and his colleagues and graduate students. He has done extensive work on control, the species distribution. The map of Florida on the right is from a publication of the ceratopogonid distribution in the state. And he has worked in some other places, publications on Paris Island, Honduras. He's looked at the species distribution. Quite a bit of work, and I think this is, I don't know where this is from, but I'm going to tell people it was Yankee Town, because Yankee Town was an area on the Gulf Coast of Florida where Dan did a great deal of work, and we've heard many times about experiments that that he had done in dispersal larval habitat of salt marsh culicoides in that area, and it's his research area. That's a really nice place. Where is that?
Actually, that's Cedar Key, north of
Houston. Oh, okay. On the right coast.
On the
right. As he has indicated, he has done work in personal protection, nets. I assume that some of this is with the military, also repellent chemicals. Dan, these are pictures that Dan kindly sent to me. And I was wondering about the one on the lower left. She's got an awful lot unprotected. But anyway, he's worked with insecticide application for control and onto screens and nets. He's also looked at the converse, attractants and traps. In the lower part there is different colored Nitzi traps, and then I'm not sure what the others are, but what they're actually called. But these are some of the, I know the upper right one is, at least one time was commercially available, unique way of collecting blood-sucking insects, culicoides being Dan's main interest. And he has worked on the applied practical application of this science to the control. And here again are some slides that he sent me for aerial control. He has looked at various insecticides, adulticides, I'm assuming, in the with the airplane and the ULV on the pickup truck, and I assume that those are tide gates on the right, where you can use environmental modification in order to prevent the change the environment so that it's unusable for culicoides larvae. Okay, we get into the one part that I know a little bit about, and I'm very pleased to show this picture. This is a very, very young Brad Mullins, and he's not here, but he sent this to me, so he knows that it's showing up. And this is a Manitoba trap that we built, and he and I started a program there, and we onto Bannets that he worked on for his master's degree. and the primary focus of this was Manitoba traps, finding out, you know, the first things, what is there, when they occur, and so forth. And we set traps in a variety of places in eastern Tennessee, and got good ideas on the seasonal distribution, what species were present, and so forth. And Brad showed at this time that he showed some of his promise very early. I was very glad to get him because he was obviously a bright student. But he started noticing things that the rest of us, that I certainly just looked at. And he says, you know, it looks like these horseflies, the same species, are landing the same place on the cow all the time. And I said, well, that's pretty interesting. And so we made this outline of a cow, and we started looking at cows while they were being attacked and putting a mark down when a species landed in a certain place. And we could actually do this even though there were a large number of horseflies, because we knew from our other studies which ones were flying from the traps. And a lot of these things are different sized, different colored, and so forth. And there were some exceptions to that. The first one on the bottom there, we had to put two of them together because they were ones that, at the distance that we were looking at, we couldn't tell the difference. So we had to put those two species together. But we had quite a number of those that we were able to do, and indeed, these horseflies were attacking the cattle. The ones that were attacking the cattle at any given time were using different parts of the body. And we kind of assumed that this was resource partitioning. This was also an example of be very careful what you put into a publication, because we said that in this publication we were extremely careful using all the weasel words, because we had measured the depth of hair and the length of mouth parts. And we said, it's possible that they may be dividing it up this way because of the ones with the longer mouth parts tend to be in the area where the hair is thicker. The next publication that came out on this said this was absolutely the way it was, and they left out all the weasel words, and then we were the one that had to take the blame for that. As a result of this, we got we made a station publication. Jim Godwin had been working in Tennessee for many years, and we included seasonal distribution and the distribution within the state, and we were very pleased to get the help from Bakuman and Teske and some of the other people that Brad had met at the biting fly workshop. I did some Culicoides work. It's primarily host seeking. We had deer, and you can see the face of a cow right there. This is a mobile magoon trap and a drop trap that we got here. Leigh Haribar is one of my students that I'm proud of that helped with that work. Brad's California work. He has had an extensive program on Culicoides, among other things, impact on dairy, larval habitat, and that is indicated here, some attempts at control by spraying the belly, which was not particularly successful, according to Brad. He has also done some host work, both on domestic livestock. And that says Alec Gary there, and I know that that's not a picture. The previous one was Alec. And that's a bighorn sheep that he's doing he's done some work with Culicoides disease organism transmission in bighorn sheep and species of quail that they have there. And Dick Axtell's legacy continues to spread overseas. This is the distribution of blue tongue in Europe, and Brad Mullins has been cooperating in recent years with researchers in in Spain on their culicoides associated with blue tongue in Spain. So we got guys going to Spain. This is one of the neat places you get to work at if you work in the state of Tennessee. It's part of Cades Cove and the Smokies. Thank you very much.